From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The nation is weeks away from getting a new president. So today we spend the hour talking about presidential history in Georgia. Not the one president that was born here, Jimmy Carter, but some of the lesser known connections between the Peach State and the White House. We start with the first female candidate for president. Then we'll talk about Thomas Jefferson's rule for governing. And finally, was Lincoln a spiritual Southerner?
His fatalism in religion is very characteristically Southern, and particularly when we think of the South as not all just planters, but there's a strong yeoman culture. Many more people did not own slaves than owned slaves. And thirdly, I think it's important to remember that African Americans are also Southerners, and there's some identification there with the hard work his father had had him do, that he identified with in fact, African-Americans, and his theology is similar in some ways to African-American theology.
That's all coming up this hour, but we want to hear from you. What is the number one most essential quality that a president needs? Is it business acumen, maybe? Diplomacy? Good communication skills?
It seems like an amalgam of wanting Mother Teresa, Mandela, Rambo, the Terminator, and Spider-Man all wrapped into one. It's a pretty outlandish job description.
What is number one on the list of essential presidential skills? Call and give us your thoughts. It's 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet to @OSTTalk, and we might feature your comments on the show.
This is not the outcome we wanted or we worked so hard for, and I'm sorry that we did not win this election for the values we share and the vision we hold for our country.
Hillary Clinton did not become the first female president of the U.S., but she was the first presidential nominee of a major party. Not the first presidential nominee of any party, though. That title goes to Victoria Woodhull, who ran for president in 1872. Her candidacy made her a trailblazer during a time that predated even women's suffrage.
Victoria spent Election Day, November 5, 1872, in the Ludlow Street Jail. President Ulysses Grant was reelected. Several newspapers mentioned that the Equal Rights Party was on the ballot. But some people believed because Victoria was in jail, no one took the few thousand votes seriously.
A TV documentary about Woodhull called America's Victoria was produced in 1998, and the filmmaker is Victoria Lynn Weston of Georgia. I spoke with her last year.
I was drawn to Victoria Woodhull because, other than the fascination of she was the first woman to run for U.S. president, she also was an individual that was psychic, and it was her psychic abilities and intuitive abilities that I believe was the driving force behind her that sort of, you know, compelled her and propelled her into becoming as successful as she was. And it wasn't just, you know, the first woman for president, because a lot of people don't realize that even though Victoria Woodhull was the first woman, she was also the first woman before women even had the right to vote. But what's interesting about her is that she grew up dirt poor. She had a rather violent childhood. Her father, Buck Kaplan, he was basically a petty criminal, and he would go out and burn down the barns to try to collect the insurance money. So, and she didn't even go to, you know, grade school. I think when she started, she was more around the age of 8. And then the father decided, it was at the height of spiritualism then, so he
right.
decided shortly thereafter that she could, you know, had these psychic abilities, and he was going to pack her up along with her more flirty sister, Tennessee, and they started this traveling medicine show. So they went around the country, and he would have these elixirs that he would, you know, snake oil kinds of stuff that he would promote, and Victoria would provide readings and that. And that's how she kind of started into that. And then she met her first husband, who was a doctor.
Well, let me interrupt you there for just a second, Victoria, and try to take us back to the time and place that we're talking about here. This is a clip from Scott Claflin, a descendant of Victoria Woodhull's, and he's talking about sort of what rights women had and didn't have in the late 1800s.
This was an era where a woman could not vote, could not enter a restaurant, a store, an establishment of any kind unless she was escorted by a man. It was controversial for women to do anything, but she had the foresight not to accept the way society was.
So she ran in 1872 representing the Equal Rights Party. How did that come about?
Well, it came about is when she basically became friends with Cornelia Vanderbilt and then married Colonel Blood, and then basically developed a male brain trust. And these men really liked Victoria Woodhull. They liked her voice, her gift of oration, and the fact that she was gorgeous. So it was General Benjamin Butler that had invited her to speak. She was also the first woman to speak for the House Judiciary Committee in 1870. And she talked about the 14th and 15th Amendment and argued that women had the right to vote because they were simply taxpayers. And because you're a taxpayer, that gave you the right to vote. And at that point, the black people were allowed to vote at that point as well. But they denied any women voting at that juncture. So then what happened is she became so popular that the women's suffrage movement, you know, with Susan B. Anthony and Katie Stanton, and Victoria wanted to be part of that group. But even Susan B. Anthony didn't like that because Victoria had all these wonderful men, powerful, influential men
right.
around her, and she didn't like that, so they kind of shunned her. But that didn't stop her from moving on to the next step.
Right. Let's hear, actually, this is from the documentary film that you made. This is, I guess, an actress reading as Susan B. Anthony here.
If she were influenced by women's spirits, I might consent. But she is wholly owned and dominated by men's spirits, and I spurn the control of the whole lot of them.
And it seemed like, you know, this is a woman, I mean, I'm talking about Victoria Woodhull at this point. She was born poor, as you mentioned. She twice made her fortune and then lost it. She was a female stockbroker. She was a newspaper editor. This is a woman that was into a lot of things. That's fair to say, right?
Absolutely. Well, she was extremely ambitious, and she didn't really know where she was going to make her mark in the world. She knew that, you know, she was driven. She wanted to have success, and she had a bite of it, and then she'd lose it and then rebuilt it again. As far as the stockbrokers, again, her in Tennessee, they were known as the Queens of Finance. They were the first women to do that. And then she opened up a newspaper, Woodhull Claflin Weekly. And probably the thing that really, you know, was the first downfall with Woodhull is she deplored hypocrisy. She couldn't stand anybody that was a hypocrite. And back to the platform that she ran on, free love, equal rights for men and women, but the free love movement meant that if you were married, you shouldn't be confined by laws. That if a couple fell out of love, they should be free to move on to somebody else without having to go through, you know, a divorce and that sort of thing.
Right. It wasn't the free love that we think of from, like, the 1960s and 70s. She meant your freedom to marry and divorce and then, choose whether or not to have children without anybody interfering. Not.
Right. So at that point, she decided that, you know, Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, who was one of the most popular liberal preachers at that time, that he should stand shoulder to shoulder with her and talk about this free love movement, because Beecher, after all, was having an affair, you know, in the church with Theodore Tilden's wife, after all. And she thought, well, here you're doing this behind closed doors. Come stand with me in the front, and let's go and let's, you know, campaign about this free love movement sort of thing. Of course, Beecher wouldn't have anything to do with that. He said, absolutely not. Well, that just really infuriated Woodhull, who decided to go ahead and write about him in the newspaper. Well, that infuriated further, you know, Beecher saying, oh, you're not going to do that. I'm going to have you, you know, arrested for libel and this, that, and the other. And it became this big lawsuit, if you will, because Woodhull ended up having to go to jail on election day for libel. And,
yeah.
And that was because of Beecher and that. And, you know.
And she, I mean, there was a lot of criticism of her paper that published opinions on things like sex education, women's suffrage, of course, wearing short skirts, vegetarianism, and also legal prostitution. But let's take a listen here. This is Amanda Friskin talking about the fact that, and as a pioneer, Victoria Woodhull, for women at least, is kind of a little bit of a tarnished heroine.
It makes for a very complicated founding narrative for women. You want someone really beyond reproach. You want the George Washington for women, and you don't get that with Woodhull. She was a flawed first, but she's still the first.
Amanda Friskin wrote a biography about Victoria Woodhull, but you know, let's talk about Election Day. As far as I could find, we don't know if there was even any votes cast for her, correct?
Well, what I had found years ago was that there actually was votes cast, and it was, you know, approximately 5,000 to 7,000 votes. Whether that's, you know, somebody can go through and confirm, that's another thing. But that's what I found, that she did actually have some votes.
but didn't actually get any, certainly didn't get any traction. And it was a long time before we got another female candidate. What happened to her political career and all her other many other careers? Because she lived until almost 1930. What happened after the election?
Well, after the election, I mean, she nominated herself for president, you know, not once, not twice, but up to four times. So after the election, you know, she was still campaigning about free love and equal rights and this, that, and the other. But their friendship with Cornelius Vanderbilt, you know, spanned several years in that, and then he eventually died. And his son didn't want any, you know, any fallout and any legal issues with Victoria or the sister, so he paid them $100,000 to leave the country. So Victoria packed up everything, got on a ship with her sister, and they moved to England. She reinvented herself, or is what we would say today, rebranded herself and started campaigning again, but was really a proponent of eugenics at that point.
Oh.
Then she met a rich, wealthy, dashing banker, Bidoff Martin, and she married him. And then she still continued on with equal rights and did a lot for children, launched schools, did, you know, some really wonderful things that, you know, for charitable, you know, causes.
Just for those who don't recognize the term eugenics, that's the movement in which that used selective breeding and sterilization and thought there were superior and inferior races for the most part. But I wonder how you feel. Before we go, Victoria, give me your thoughts on her legacy. There, many people have, you know, as you just heard Amanda mention, that she was perhaps not the best pioneer that women could have chosen in politics, at least. What's your thought on that?
I think Woodhull is a wonderful woman. I think she's not flawed. I think she is a representation of the American dream. Here is an individual that had no education, was dirt poor, and she made something of herself. And she was successful, not in one area, but several areas. She was a publisher. She was a Wall Street broker. She made money on her own. And I think women can go away from that, and men too, that to think of Woodhull is to think of to be daring, outrageous, and courageous, and to go out there and do anything that you want to do. And she represents that.
And would we have had Hillary Clinton without Victoria Woodhull?
I don't think so. I think eventually, if say Woodhull wasn't there, then we go on to the next woman and that. I think it certainly paves the trail. If Hillary Clinton was the first one, we could say the same. She's a very flawed candidate. She has a lot of baggage around her too, but Hillary's a strong, independent woman. She knew what to do to get to this point, and she's going to do a wonderful job there. So flawed or not, you take those flaws and you smooth them out and you make the best of it.
I guess it's called being human. Victoria Lynn Weston is the director of the film America's Victoria, Remembering Victoria Woodhull. It's about the first woman who ran for president in the U.S. Victoria, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Have a great day.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. After Donald Trump is inaugurated as president, it's assumed he'll appoint someone to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ultimately decides how to interpret the language of the Constitution. And because we're focused on Georgia's presidential history this hour, we thought we'd talk about the rule that's named for the country's third president. What exactly did the Founding Fathers intend? That answer depends on who you ask.
They created a strong government with powers of united action, sufficient then and now.
And that the purpose of the Constitution, as Thomas Jefferson put it, is to serve as chains to bind the mischief of government.
If you read our founding fathers, people like Benjamin Franklin and Jefferson, what we're doing in this country now is making them roll over in their graves.
That's President Franklin Roosevelt, Senator Ted Cruz, and CNBC's Rick Santelli. It's pretty common to hear politicians invoke the Founding Fathers or talk about getting back to the original intention of the Constitution. But you will not hear David Sahat say that. He's a history professor at Georgia State University and author of The Jefferson Rule. Last year, I spoke to him and Stan Deaton at the Georgia Historical Society. And I began by asking David about how he came to the argument that we can't really talk about getting back to the Founding Fathers' original intent because they didn't agree on anything.
Well, I was finishing my last book, and I'd read a lot of the Founding Fathers when I was doing that last book. And right as I was finishing it, the contemporary Tea Party began. And I thought, gosh, you know, the Founding Fathers that I hear the Tea Party talk about are not the founding fathers that I've found in the historical record. And I thought, how did we get here in the 21st century to be talking, arguing really over these founding fathers that are 2 centuries old? And so I decided to go and kind of do a history of where this came from and to evaluate its consequences in American politics.
To one extent, Stan, it's nice to hear people talking about history, right?
Right.
In a contemporary view. But mm-hmm. do you also feel as though people are kind of misinterpreting the founding of our country?
I do. I think there's a sense we have of romanticizing the past. It was a better time. We were less divided. These people were smarter than we are. They figured it out. And as David has said, they didn't. They were not smarter than we are. They were as divided as we are. And somehow, though, if we can invoke them, we feel like it gives your argument a credibility that it may or may not have. It puts you on the right side of history.
And David, one of the things I found most interesting in your book was, you know, Stan's talking about they were better and smarter than we are. They were pretty petty. I mean, they were mean to yeah. each other. When they yeah. were disagreed, they tried to ruin the other person's life. And I'm talking about like Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, right? I mean, that's,
right.
yeah.
yeah. Yeah, it's astounding to go back and read the Founding Fathers and to read about their political disputes, because they disagreed with one another so strongly, and they wanted to really destroy not just their ideas, but their opponents' political careers. They wanted them to go away and to never come back. And it's a lot like how you hear a contemporary conservative refer to Obama, or sometimes how you hear liberals refer to contemporary conservatives. But it almost strikes me as worse, because these people, it was a much smaller circle, and they were just almost more vicious than.
Well, Patrick Henry hated the Constitution, right?
Yeah, right.
Did not like it. He hated it so much that he then transferred that hate to one of the original authors of the Constitution, James Madison.
Right.
Is this all correct?
This is
accurate?
All correct, yes.
Right.
And then he tried to ruin James Madison's political career by gerrymandering the district so he'd lose to James Monroe.
Right, yeah.
I mean, this is not the kind of dignified,
say,
honorable men we think of.
Part of the thing we have to remember is that for them, this was all new. We're looking back downstream over 200 years. We know the experiment that they set up has succeeded. They didn't know that, and they didn't know what was going to happen. So, as David says, they saw their political opponents as not only wrong, but dangerous for the future. They had lived through the Revolution. They had each of them done something to contribute to independence and setting up this new government. So Hamilton thought Jefferson, and Jefferson thought Hamilton, was not just wrong, but out of sync with the Revolution, dangerous, taking us down a road. We use those words now. They meant it, that something was going to happen that was really going to be bad if their opponents won.
Kind of puts into context all those duels and Andrew mm-hmm, Jackson. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, Stan, what did they think about the lasting nature of their writings? In other words, did they assume that the Constitution would be amended? Did they assume that some of the things they put on paper would be changed?
I think one of the ways that we can look at them and realize they did know this was going to change is the amendment process in the Constitution. As one historian said, it has freed us from the icy grip of the past. They hoped that it would last a long time. Some of them thought it might last 20 years. That had been the model. I mean, the Articles mm-hmm. of Confederation had not lasted long at all. This was a new thing in the world. I think they hoped it would last a long time. I think that's one reason they didn't set it up so specifically to change over time.
All right. So, David and Stan, we have a whole bunch of comments from politicians through the years, and I'm going to play them for you, and you can tell me bogus or not bogus invocation of the Founding Fathers, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Let's begin in 1920. This is July, and here is Warren G. Harding accepting the Republican nomination for the presidency. Take a listen.
It was the intent of the Founding Fathers to give this republic a dependable and enduring popular government, representative in form, and it was designed to make political parties the effective agencies through which hopes and aspirations and convictions and conscience may be translated into public performance.
David?
Bogus.
Bogus.
Because it refers to political parties, and the Founding Fathers rejected political parties specifically. And you'll read the Constitution and you won't find any reference to political parties, because they thought that political parties would tear the nation apart and would be a step toward despotism.
Okay, let's move on to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and we'll get Stan into this too. This is the second inaugural address from January of 1937, and again, he's invoking the Founding Fathers here.
At that convention, our forefathers found the way out of the chaos that followed the Revolutionary War. They created a strong government with powers of united action, sufficient then and now to solve problems utterly beyond individual or local action.
Stan, bogus or credible?
That's credible. I think within the confines of what he's talking about, he is clearly talking in the middle of the Great Depression, the New Deal. This is something new in the world.
Yeah, he's justifying the New Deal.
He's justifying the New Deal, and I think he's right. The chaos of the 1780s after the Revolution, they were looking for a strong central government that could do enough to unify and really give powers that the government needed, but not too much. I think within the confines of what he's saying, he's right.
Okay, let's go fast forward here quite a bit to August 28th of 1963. Here is Martin Luther King Jr. He delivered his I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And here he is within that speech quoting words from the Constitution.
When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Very optimistic words. David, bogus or not?
That's tricky. I would say if we're referring to what the founders intended, bogus, because I cannot imagine slave-owning people, and a plurality of the founders were slave owners, would have imagined that a black man would stand in front of the Lincoln Memorial and assume that they would be that their words would be put to that end. But if we assume that their ideas grow over time and take on new meanings over time, then not bogus.
Okay, Stan, you're shaking your head, so yeah, no disagreement there. Let's now go to Ronald Reagan. We're now in the 1980s, specifically the State of the Union address in January of 1982, and here he is talking about state power.
This administration has faith in state and local governments and the constitutional balance envisioned for the founding fathers.
Okay, he just is saying, basically saying there's the Constitution sets up a balance of state and local governments. Bogus? Credible.
I think it's the Constitution was designed to find that middle ground that was so difficult between a strong, it's a federal system, a shared power. That's what makes it so difficult. And the founders, Madison, Hamilton, Washington, Franklin, the men who were sitting in the Constitutional Convention didn't quite know how it would work. Power shared was going to be power, there's going to be conflict. And we still argue over that. We don't know how that works all the time. And they didn't either. But I think within the confines, again, with what he's saying, I think he's right. That's what they were trying to do.
All right, David, you next. Okay, this is actually Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz, who we all know very much likes to invoke the Founding Fathers and talk about the Constitution. That's basically how he announced his presidency, bringing us back to the original intent, right? So here he is talking about his plans to run for president.
What is the promise of America? The idea that the revolutionary idea that this country was founded upon, which is that our rights, they don't come from man. They come from God Almighty. And that the purpose of the Constitution, as Thomas Jefferson put it, is to serve as chains to bind the mischief of government.
David, two things there. Our ideas come from God, and the government's purpose, I mean, the Constitution is there to bind government. Bogus or not?
That's trickier. I would say bogus on the idea that our rights come from God. God is referenced in passing in the Declaration, but rights come from we the people in the Constitution, and God is not mentioned in the Constitution except the phrase in the year of our Lord. And then in terms of binding the actions of men...
Binding the mischief of the government.
Okay, binding the mischief of the government. Jefferson believed that, but the other founding fathers disagreed, or many of the other founding fathers disagreed, so I'm going to say bogus.
Okay, that makes it sound, though, as though the Constitution was written with the suspicion already that the federal government needs to be restrained.
Well, the Constitution was written with the suspicion that the federal government needed to be strengthened after the Articles of Confederation. And many of the drafters of the Constitution were trying to transfer power from the states, which had too much, to the federal government, which had too little. Mm. And many of the people who resisted the Constitution worried that they had transferred too much power. And after the Constitution was ratified, they then fell over fighting how that was to work out in practice, where the states had power and the federal government had power.
Okay, in our bogus or not game, Stan, you get the last one. This is former Alaska governor and Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin, and here she is speaking on Fox News with Bill O'Reilly.
It is an attempt to revisit and rewrite history. I think we should just kind of keep this clean, keep it simple, go back to what our founders and our founding documents meant. They're quite clear that we would create law based on the God of the Bible and the Ten Commandments. It's pretty simple.
Okay, so we kind of touched on this a little bit with David. She says it's quite clear that our Constitution and our laws are based on the laws of the Bible. Bogus or no?
Bogus. I think the Constitution itself, if you read it, as David said, all the references to religion in the Constitution as it was written before there was a Bill of Rights are negatives. There won't be any religious test to hold office. It's just simply not there. Most of the founders were deists. The Declaration speaks of nature's God. I think that's often misunderstood.
Explain what a deist is.
A deist is someone who believes that God reveals himself, the creator of the universe reveals himself through nature, not through divine revelation. We know God because of the world around us, not because somehow
a prophet came.
Because of divine revelation.
Okay, so David, let's go a little bit further before we stop into exactly the purpose of your book, mm-hmm. right? You're not going to get politicians to stop talking about the Founding Fathers.
No.
So who are you speaking to in this book?
I would love to speak to the people who listen to the politicians, because I think what politicians are doing when they reference the Founding Fathers is they're using the popular affection for the Founding Fathers that the electorate has, and they're trying to kind of harness them for their own political ends. And often they're recreating the Founding Fathers in their own image. And I think if we recognized, I think if the public recognized that, A, when politicians invoke the founders, they are creating them, and B, that the founders lived a long time ago, had massive disagreements, and can't be sort of used for the political purposes that they're being put, then that might go away and we can have a different kind of debate.
I mean, Stan, you're a historian, so obviously history is incredibly important to you. But at the same time, what is a historian's view on these documents like the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and whether they should be kept sacrosanct? Did we expect these documents to remain intact and unchanged, you say, 20 years maybe, but was their original intent even useful to us now in the 21st century?
Well, I think the genius of the document is that it created a system that could flourish in a world they couldn't imagine. Right? Railroads, mass communication, the things we deal with in the 21st century that was far beyond their radar. I think their genius was in creating something that could be flexible across the years and accommodate women voting, women holding office, African Americans holding office, a world they would not have tolerated and wouldn't have imagined. But at the end of the day, if the world changed enough for us to be okay with that, I think they were okay with it. And I think that's the genius of the document. But we shouldn't look to them as somehow geniuses or demigods, as Jefferson called them, because, as David says, they weren't. They created a system and then knew they were launching an experiment. And so it remains.
David, do you want to add to that?
No. No, I think that's good. I mean, the only thing is that, in a certain sense, they created this system and then the one thing about that system that I always pause over is that the nation tore itself apart within three generations of the Founding Fathers. And so we talk about the long-lasting nature of the system, but it really wasn't that long-lasting. The Civil War was a catastrophe in American life, and it represented the failure of the Founding Fathers. The foundations of the nation came apart. And the three post-Civil War amendments were added, which significantly changed the constitutional arrangement in order to prevent a new Civil War from breaking out. And so, in a certain sense, you know, the chasm of the Civil War was so great that we could never even get back to the Founding Fathers, even if we wanted to, because the Constitution is so different.
David Sahat is a history professor at Georgia State University. His new book is called The Jefferson Rule. It's a great read. Stan Deaton is senior historian at the Georgia Historical Society. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Coming up, we continue our focus on presidential history. One expert thinks Abraham Lincoln had Southern roots. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. This hour, we're talking about presidents. So let's talk about Lincoln. Born in Kentucky, raised in Indiana, Lincoln became a lawyer and politician in Illinois. Lincoln is known as the Great Emancipator, the Rail Splitter, Honest Abe, and Father Abraham. He was many things to many people, but one historian looks at Lincoln through his Southern sensibilities. You heard that right. I spoke last year with Vernon Burton. He's the author of The Age of Lincoln, and he joined me from Clemson University in South Carolina, where he teaches. We were also joined by Louisiana State University history professor Bill Cooper, who studied extensively on Jefferson Davis. And also joining us from New York was NYU history professor Martha Hodes. She wrote a book on the Southern response to Lincoln's death. I began by asking Vernon why he believes Lincoln was so influenced by Southern heritage.
Well, of course, Lincoln is born in Kentucky. His father and grandfather are born in Virginia and moved there. And even Lincoln, when he sort of ponders perhaps a maternal grandfather, he projects that that might actually be a plantation owner, an enslaved owner. But it's part of a larger argument that there was a great Southern migration. We know about Kentucky, but particularly there was a migration into the lower part of Ohio, the lower part of Indiana, of course, all of Missouri, and Southern Illinois. And there were two groups of Southerners who migrated into those areas. There was one group who really hated African Americans and wanted to get away from them, and that accounts to some degree for the extraordinary racism that we discover in those areas. But there were also those like Lincoln's family, Thomas Lincoln, who hated slavery itself and wanted to get away.
That was his father.
That's right, Thomas Lincoln's father. And I think Bill will probably note, too, that Jefferson Davis is born within 100 miles of where Lincoln's born, and Sam Davis. Davis's father goes south toward Mississippi. Lincoln's father goes first to Indiana and then to Illinois. But to give you an example of the Southern characteristics, Springfield, Illinois, which becomes Lincoln's home and where he really felt that he belonged, later in his life, was first named Calhoun after none other than John C. Calhoun. His the community that he first settled in when he was on his own, New Salem, was primarily a community of former Southerners who had come into that area, including Ann Rutledge by way of most of them in Tennessee, but the Rutledges of South Carolina.
So what were these? Now, you list a number of ways in which this Southern tradition and culture influenced not only his character, but his tenure as president. What were those?
Well, certainly his sense of honor. The way historians use honor is certainly different than the general public. There is a sort of a way the anthropologists, historians argue that in the North you had a culture of dignity that's much more internal, whereas in the South you have a sense of honor that's driven by the esteem of the community. That is what others thought of you. Therefore, you get the touchiness that leads to duels and sort of that famous Southern quick response. Lincoln himself was involved in a duel. I think that honor becomes tempered over time as he finds this sort of sense of esteem in different ways. And when he becomes president, and he sort of develops a different sense of honor. But again and again, he says, there's so many quotations, but certainly there's one when he has said, people are trying to convince him, let South Carolina and the South go, better than war. And he says, where is the Washington in that? Where is the Jackson in that? Where is the honor in that? There is no honor. So he appeals to that sense of honor over and over again as well. Also, I think his fatalism in religion is very characteristically Southern, and particularly when we think of the South as not all just planters, but there's a strong yeoman culture. Many more people did not own slaves than owned slaves. And thirdly, I think it's important to remember that African Americans are also Southerners, and there's some identification there with the hard work his father had had him do, that he identified with in fact, African-Americans, and his theology is similar in some ways to African-American theology.
Well, Bill Cooper, let me take this to you. Another thing that Vernon points out is Lincoln's sort of laconic storytelling habits and other things like that. But that view is relatively controversial. What do you think of that?
Vernon knows I don't agree with him about Lincoln and Southern. I think in the secession crisis, one of the hallmarks of Lincoln's actions was his ignorance of the South. I don't think he knew anything at all about the South. He only had contacts with the border of Kentucky where his wife came from, and his best friend, a man named Joshua Speed, was a Kentuckian. But Lincoln had not traveled in the South below Kentucky since as a teenager he'd come on flatboats down in New Orleans twice. He had no Southern political contacts. He was in Congress in the late 40s for one term, and he did know Southerners there, most famously perhaps Alexander Stevens of Georgia. But he and Stevens had absolutely no contact between the time that they left Congress and 1860. I think he was basically ignorant about Southern politics. I don't think he understood how much Southerners feared the kind of language he used and the kind of language his party used about the South. For example, he talked one of the most famous speeches. He said that the Union couldn't exist half slave and half free as it had been since the beginning. And one of his speeches on the way from Springfield to Washington to be inaugurated, he made a speech in Cincinnati where he talked about his care for the South, and he said that he and his party would treat the South just as Washington and Jefferson and Madison had treated the South. Well, that was a total disconnect from most other things that he said. When he actually got to Washington, he does seem to have tempered a bit, and he talked about the need for him and his party and for Southerners to get to know each other better, and once they got to know each other better, he thought they would get along better. But I do think that his hard, fast adherence to a particular policy during the secession crisis had a good bit to do with his ignorance of the South. Not totally now, not totally, but a good bit to do with it.
Let's step away from that particular debate for just a second, and let me go to Martha Hodes, because I wonder what you learned in terms of people of the time and their view of Lincoln. Since you spent so much time sort of detailing the response to his death around the country, what did people then think of him?
Well, the Confederate reaction to Lincoln's assassination is really quite fascinating. For one thing, Lincoln's assassination came very shortly after Confederate defeat. So the first thing is that was really the moment of tremendous despair for Confederates. And you can see in people's personal writings how this is manifest. So, for example, a Confederate officer wrote in his diary, "Heard of Lincoln's death, Mobile and Columbus lost," almost dismissing Lincoln's death for the close of the war. You also have a North Carolina soldier who wrote in his diary about bitter, bitter humiliation, and then squeezed in on the side of the page, rumors of Lincoln's death. And then when the rumors were confirmed, he squeezed in on the side, Lincoln's assassination confirmed. But you also have Confederate glee at Lincoln's death, and this is a really interesting reaction. So you have things like a 17-year-old girl from South Carolina who writes in her diary, "Hurrah, old Abe Lincoln has been assassinated." And then her family gathers together and they all say, she writes this down in her diary, "Isn't it splendid?" But they also understand that glee is a moment of reprieve from defeat that's not going to last. So I found a diary from a Georgia plantation mistress who writes that Lincoln's assassination was only, and these are her words, "one sweet drop among so much that is painful." And Confederates also know that Lincoln might have acted in their interests. They're not sure. One of the most amazing things about Lincoln is that both the Confederates call him their best friend, and that's right after the assassination. That's not a lost cause development that comes later. And freed people, former slaves, also call Lincoln their best friend. And I think Vernon's point about Southerners, African Americans also being Southerners, is very important. So, of course, African Americans in the South, and of course in the North as well, respond with shock and sorrow, horror and disbelief. They say things like, "I would rather have died myself," or "I'm nearly deranged with grief." A black soldier called it a loss irreparable. That was a man from the 54th Massachusetts. Yeah. So the responses of white Southerners and black Southerners are diametrically opposed, except that both think Lincoln might have been their best friend had he lived.
Well, Vernon, let me put that to you then. Is that influenced by whether or not they wanted to work with Andrew Johnson, who came after Lincoln? Maybe they saw Lincoln as the lesser of two evils.
Well, I really enjoyed Martha's book, who talks about that. Yes, that's part of it. But I want to go back a little bit more to defend the argument about Lincoln and Southern characteristics. Whether he is right politically or not is very different than he has these characteristics that are those of Southerners. And I think that's important to make that distinction and difference. You know, I would argue, as opposed to Bill, in his Southern presidential address, he wrote about these issues that Lincoln did not know the South. And I started doing my presidential address, but backed off saying it was Jefferson Davis who didn't know the North, because Lincoln could not have got two dozen people to have gone down to a fault against the South if, in fact, the South, the Confederacy, that is, I should use the word the Confederacy, had not fired on Fort Sumter. And, of course, Lincoln believes that there are a lot of good Southern Unionists, and I'm not sure he's wrong on that. There's that Andrew Jackson Unionism is strong in the South, but the way that the politics developed really makes a difference. In most states, you know, white Southerners don't get to vote whether or not they go to civil war or not. They're just led into it.
Well, let me take that to you, Bill, then. You mentioned Lincoln's relationship with the one-time Georgia congressman and then later governor, Alexander Stephens. But, you know, one thing that people may not know about Georgia is that Atlanta argued strenuously against seceding from the Union, although the state went. So, I mean, is it possible that Lincoln had stronger ties or a better understanding of the South as a person, maybe not as a president, than many people assume?
No, I don't think so. I think if Lincoln had understood the South and he had made, as president-elect, if he had stood up and said openly and publicly that he was president of all the people, and that Southerners would be just as accepted by him as Northerners, and in fact, would be very specific. At one point, he secretly let the word come to Senator Seward in Washington that he would support the first 13th Amendment. But that fell by the wayside. He backed away from that until the day he was inaugurated. In his inaugural address, he announced his support for the first 13th Amendment, which would have made slavery basically perpetual until the Southern states decided to divest themselves of it. If he had said something like that publicly in late November, early December, Georgia, for example, the secessionists in Georgia had a very difficult time getting Georgia out anyway.
Yeah.
I think it would have made the secessionist struggle even more difficult if he had said openly and publicly things like support for the 13th Amendment or things like Southerners were just as good of Americans as he was and as Republicans were. He never said anything like that openly and publicly. And when the secessionists talked about Lincoln and his party as being devils and horrors to the South, those people who opposed secession, who didn't want to go out, they had very little to fall back on to say, look, the Republicans aren't so bad. Look at what the president-elect is saying. He never said anything publicly.
Can I respond to that?
You can,
very quickly?
Brian.
And I don't want to just be between Bill and me, but, you know, Lincoln is married to a Southerner, Mary Todd, a border Southerner, slave owning, but she was known to have fits, really bad fits and throw fits, and Lincoln's pattern was just to walk away and say nothing. And I think he's playing out this family drama again. He basically didn't say anything until his election. That was part of his strategy. And I believe that he thought that, in fact, that if he gave the South time, they would come to their senses, that is the Confederacy time, and Confederate leaders, and it would be all okay. So I think he may have been wrong in that strategy, not doing what Bill would suggest. But I think his thinking politically was that he really shouldn't say anything until he was president. I think he did misjudge just how angry, in fact, a state like South Carolina was, and it was not like his wife who would calm down.
Well, let me end with you, Martha, since the reason we're talking is to mark the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's death. I mean, you stayed away. I found it interesting. You stayed away from newspaper accounts and stuck to really going through people's letters and their personal diaries and things. So what sense did you get? Did the South view Lincoln as a Northerner Was he like the other?
Well, Confederates have such an interesting relationship to Lincoln if you look through their personal writings, because on the one hand, they're gleeful. They despise Lincoln. They, even after he's assassinated, they call him all sorts of names. They call him an ape. They call him, they curse at him. They say all kinds of fascinating things in their private writings and also to one another because they record their conversations. And then at the same time, as I mentioned before, there's a fear. There's a fear that Lincoln is gone. So, for example, Mary Chestnut, the South Carolina diarist, she says this foul murder will bring worse miseries down upon us. Then there's a Confederate officer in a Union prison who says, very interesting statement here. He says, the principal cause of our feeling the matter so strongly, in other words, responding emotionally to the assassination, is the question of how it will affect us. And then what's so fascinating about white Southerners is they see defeat very specifically in terms of enslavement to the Yankees. And as a slave society, even if most people weren't slave owners, as a slave society, they're using that metaphor. They know exactly what they're doing in using that metaphor. So a woman from Georgia writes in her diary that white Southerners were living, after defeat, in bondage worse than slavery. African Americans, they consider Lincoln to be absolutely their ally. They cannot imagine a worse loss. They are overcome with fear. They want more than just legal freedom. And that's where they appeal to the model of Lincoln. When they go to Andrew Johnson, when they appeal to the new president for what they want beyond just legal freedom, beyond just the 13th Amendment.
But actually, his death meant that it was going to be a long time coming before they had those things. I've been speaking with Abraham Lincoln historian Vernon Burton and Jefferson Davis historian Bill Cooper, and you just heard Martha Hodes. She looks at the national response to Lincoln's death in her new book, Mourning Lincoln. Thank you so much to all three of you.
Thank you, Celeste.
Really enjoyed
Thank you, and goodbye.
Celeste. Thank you.
And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear about your favorite president. We didn't talk today about the only president born in Georgia, Jimmy Carter. Is he your favorite? Who is it? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OSD Talk. I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.